Welcome to the Distributed Podcast. My name is Jonathan Oliver.
And I'm Renat Abdullin.
Today we're short a couple of co-hosts due to some scheduling conflicts, but we really wanted to introduce a guest here. He is on the LMAX, he's one of the co-architects, I guess, of the LMAX Disruptor Project, and we're very excited to talk about that. So with that, we will ask Mike Barker to introduce himself.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mike. I've been developer at LMAX for about 3 years. My current role is sort of head of the performance and stability team. And yeah, I was quite closely involved in the original design of the Disruptor, but also there's a large amount of infrastructure code that we built around it. So our own reliable messaging and our own event sourced architecture, for which the Disruptor forms a fairly key part.
Now, Mike, tell us a little bit about some of your development background. You know, what platforms have you worked on? What programming languages? You know, a lot of our audience is fairly uniform in terms of the programming languages that they like to use. So we're curious to just get an outside take here and get some of your background.
Yep, okay. I'm mostly a Java guy. I probably picked up Java first when I was at university about 12 or 13 years ago. I've done a fair amount of other stuff as well. I've done bits and pieces of C and C++ and the odd bit of .NET here and there. So mostly a Java guy. I worked for Nortel initially. It was my first job doing network management systems. And then I spent a fair bit of time doing just sort of consulting type work and systems integration and that type of stuff. A little bit of J2EE, mostly sort of core Java stuff. And that was probably, and then eventually made my way to LMAX and got a lot more involved in the high-end performance and concurrency space.
Awesome. Now, what platform are you currently working with? What's your development platform of choice as far as operating system?
We're pretty much Linux-based across the board. So even, you know, our development environment's running on Fedora. Our production environment's running on Red Hat Enterprise. It's all Java-based, a lot of core Java stuff. And we use the Resin application server as our main app server for the web end side of things.
Nice. And I'm just curious what your IDE is and stuff, because on the .NET side, it's always, you know, Visual Studio, Windows, SQL Server.
Yeah. I'm an Eclipse guy. We have quite a few people that use IntelliJ, and it's always it's always interesting to have various discussions over which one's the best.
You know, I for us being mostly .NET guys, you know, anything that JetBrains puts out, IntelliJ, PyCharm, ReSharp, or anything, you know, their build server, just I've had nothing but praise for them, because they've just an incredible team.
Yeah, they do some pretty good work. I have to admit that, even though I'm an Eclipse user.
Okay, well, we can end the podcast now then, I guess. I'd like to know a little bit about first of all, LMAX Disruptor. What, you know, can you tell us about the origins of the name? I've heard where it came from, but I just want to get it straight from the source. Why Disruptor? What was the motivation behind that name?
It's kind of a funny story. Originally, when we looked at it, it was very similar to Phases, which are a library that was introduced. I think it's what Fork Join's based on. It had a very, very similar pattern to that. So that was sort of going through the Star Trek analogy of phases and disruptors. The other name is, it came from, we wanted to be a little bit disruptive. We wanted to get people thinking about concurrency in slightly different ways and thinking about computing in slightly different ways. So if you ever look at the website and things like that, we spent a lot of time trying to explain how it works in a lot of detail, rather than just saying, here's a great framework and away you go, but trying to say, this is actually how CPUs behave, here's how various parts of concurrent systems work, and this is how the disruptor works as a result of that. So it's not just about, here's a great tool, but here's a way to, you know, improve your understanding of computers in general.
Nice. Okay. Well, let's talk for a minute about, you know, what problem were you trying to solve, and then we'll delve into some of the specifics of how it was implemented and some of the design choices. But, you know, what was the issue that caused you to say, we need to write? I mean, this is every developer right here. Let's write a framework.
Yeah. Yes, it's a good point. I mean, yeah, we probably have a little bit of the not invented here syndrome where we work, but where it came from is we were looking at reliable messaging and durable messaging for our platform. And we've got an event-sourced architecture for our system. So all of our core high-performance services run on the basis of they're purely asynchronous. They simply respond to inbound asynchronous events. They have some sort of business logic, generally sort of represented loosely like a state machine. And as they receive events, business logic rules get executed and they emit resulting events. So the idea with event sourcing is that your business state inside of that service is always recoverable by simply replaying a journal of those messages that have come into your system.
Okay, so now I need to pause you here for a second, because the canonical event sourcing that has been flying around, in at least in the .NET space, and making its way out from there, is that you have the, domain aggregates, and then you dispatch a command to this aggregate. So it's a command saying do something, and then once that the domain aggregate decides to perform that action, it publishes one or more events. And so what you're saying is that events come in and then events go out. Does that sound right? Like
it's largely the same thing. I think you could interpret events as commands, particular type of event. The core for us is that it's a consistent ordered stream of messages that are then persisted to some sort of journal. The idea being that recovery is simply about replaying that journal. So the key things for us that when we look at our event source architecture is that our journal is very fast and our business logic is deterministic. So given some initial state and some set of events, we'll always end up with the same business logic state at the end. So event sourcing for us is much more about how do we recover from failure.
Okay, so failure recovery, got it. Okay, and go ahead.
Yep, so when we started looking at durable messaging, one of the things we looked at when you start looking at event sourced architectures is you start realizing not only is their business state inside of a service deterministic, but actually the set of output events which has left your system is also deterministic. So it's just simply a function of your initial state and the set of inbound events. So it's possible to reproduce all of your outbound events by replaying your journal as well. So you start looking at that saying, well, we could implement durable messaging by whenever we send a message out, some broker type system will persist all the outbound messages. And then some downstream system, when it wants to recover, can go to that store and pull those messages back. But we felt that since we already had the messages being written to a journal, we actually already had a store of those events. It was simply had to go through the business logic in order to create the outbound events again. So the simplest solution we came up with was just to have a ring buffer when we send our messages out. So in memory, we keep a cache of those events that's been sent. And in the case where we have some downstream system goes away and comes back again and wants to late join into that stream, it can simply re-request the messages from that ring buffer. And that's where the concept of a ring buffer being central to the disruptor came from.
How big is this ring buffer?
It gets pretty big. Some cases we've got over 20 million entries in the ring buffer.
Okay.
We've gone pretty much for a pure memory system. So performance being fairly crucial to our environment, the only time we ever go to disk is to write to this very fast journal. We try to keep everything else in memory, which brings in some really interesting design constraints. So it's a lot of the design of some of our high performance systems is about really well understanding the problem domain and trying to understand what that working set is and keeping that working set such that it's not monotonically increasing. It's probably the technical term. If you're in a situation where you're trying to keep everything in memory, you have to very clearly decide about what sort of data do you no longer need in some sort of, when a transaction occurs. A good example is something like a trade. So in a financial system, you receive orders from different sets of customers. And it's only when those orders match in terms of price do you get a trade occur. But the exchange itself, once a trade has occurred and it's sent that trade out or sent it off to some other remote system, it no longer cares about it. That trade data is effectively immutable and no longer relevant to the exchange itself. So the idea is we're only keeping the current set of orders inside of our exchange and not all of the trades that have ever occurred. So that way we keep our working set, fairly monotonic. It doesn't increase over time. It'll increase probably with the number of customers, but that's simply a capacity planning issue.
Oh, and at that point you just shard your system and you have different sets of servers for different sets of customers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or generally something like by instrument, for example. So you might have one set of servers dealing with your FX instruments, another set of servers dealing with your equities instruments, for example.
Okay, my brain just exploded. I'm not too much into the financial markets. I do understand them well enough, but not at any level of depth that you guys would go into. Okay, so I do have one technical question, then I want to get back to the theory behind it, the disruptor. But what kind of RAM requirements then do you have to have? Here's all this massive stream of events, 20 million, ring buffer of 20 million buckets. What is your, 32, 64 gigs of RAM? What are you looking at on your servers?
We're actually not that high. We're around about four. I think we're running at about 4 gigs with a maximum limit of about 8.
Wow.
Our business logic doesn't actually take all that much memory. You could probably fit all the business logic into less than a gig, probably even less than 500 megs. The ring buffers do take a lot of space. One of the nice things about the finance industry is the business model's been so heavily refined. There's a fairly good understanding about the key input and outbound events. So actually you can cram them down to quite small sizes. So our events and our actual messages are pretty small, maybe 128 bytes. So 20 million, 128 byte buckets is not too bad.
Okay.
just a quick tech question. How do you serialize messages? Like custom serializers or some library or format?
We do a custom serialization. So we just define for a given message, we just define a marshaller, and that gets given an output stream it just writes to. So when a message comes in, we don't actually do any serialization out to the journal. So when a message comes in off the wire, what we're storing in the disruptor or inside that ring buffer is the serialized form. So our journaling becomes really, really simple. All we need to know is the size of the message and the bytes. We just very quickly take the serialized form out of the ring buffer and stick it into a journal file. But then it does the unmarshalling side inside the business logic, and that's just basically a class that's associated with the business object or the business message and just unserializes it into a new object.
Interesting. So you guys have your own custom serializer. What was that not invented here syndrome?
Yeah.
Was there some performance requirements related to serialization then?
It's probably our most expensive in terms of CPU effort is actually message serialization. We started initially with things like Java serialization. This was before some of the more modern ones have turned up, like protocol buffers and Thrift. Although we did some benchmarks, we think our approach is actually a bit quicker, but it doesn't have some of the nice backwards compatibility features.
You're going to open source that one too?
Probably not. It's very tightly wired into our business logic, unfortunately. For example, Java serialization is terrible in terms of performance. I mean, good examples are it stores the entire name of the fully qualified name of the class inside the serialized form. And when you're running sort of down at sort of 128 byte messages, the serialized form of the path name for that class can actually be larger than the data itself. So it becomes very, very inefficient.
Well, then how do you reassociate the data back with the message without at least storing something that says here is the original class that it was serialized from?
An integer.
You just have a little byte that's associated with the message. It's a metadata, and then
and then we have a registry of all of our marshallers and unmarshallers. If you see this number, grab this instance of the class and serialize it or deserialize it.
Nice. Okay, so let me get back to the original motivations. I mean, here's this, and we haven't even really gotten into too much about what the disruptor pattern does, but what was the motivation behind writing it? Why did you guys write another library or framework?
Yeah. Well, once we wanted to do this recoverable messaging using these ring buffers, we found that the ring buffer was effectively a replacement for a queue. So when we send a message out, it goes into a ring buffer, and then a thread on the other side does the dispatch. And that thread will handle any request to rewind and replay any messages that need to be sent as a result of some sort of late join. So we basically had a structure that did a similar sort of thing to a queue, so passing messages from one thread to another. And back before we started the disruptor project, before we started taking the whole ring buffer stuff forward, we did a lot of research on queues and how queues behave. And how long does it take to push a message from one queue to another? Because we have quite a few of these. We probably have 10 or 20 thread hops in an entire end-to-end flow.
And so you're talking just traditional consumer, producer-consumer pattern, where you've got a producer here, sticks it into a queue structure, one or more consumers read off of that and then do their work and push stuff onto another queue.
Yep. So we spend a lot of time researching that. We looked at all of the standard queuing implementations that we could find, and we did a lot of latency comparisons. And what's really what was really interesting about that is actually it's incredibly high. We're talking, if you're talking about a business transaction that's sort of got a 1 millisecond latency goal.
Okay, that was the other question. Your SLA is 1 millisecond. Is that right?
Yeah, wow. That's our goal.
Okay.
So if you've got, say, 10 thread hops via a queue, we found that some of the average latencies for some of these collections was 30, 40 microseconds. You start adding those up, 10 of those, that's 300 to 400 microseconds just spent moving a message from one thread to another. And it seems also extraordinarily high. So we just, once we had built this ring buffer structure, we benchmarked it, and our first versions were terribly, terribly slow. But when we started digging into some of the reasons for that and some of the reasons why the queuing implementations are really, really slow, we started to discover why. And the key thing for us was that in any concurrent system, the immediate thing that will kill any form of performance is contention. So it's any form of shared resource where you have multiple threads trying to write to the same piece of data. Any time that happens, you need to either use a lock or some sort of CAS operation. And once you start introducing multiple threads doing this, not only does the performance double based on the number of threads, it can skyrocket. I mean, the difference between an uncontended and a contended thread is, you know, probably, you know, it's three or four orders of magnitude.
And just a quick little alert. You said the CAS operation, which is compare and swap. You know, compare this value, and if it does match, swap. Otherwise, do something else.
Yeah. So that's a CPU level instruction, which is available in sort of .NET and Java through various different APIs, the Atomic APIs in Java, and I believe that's the Interlocked APIs in .NET. So even those under fairly heavy contention can start to slow down unexpectedly. So we came up with the idea of what's called the single writer pattern. So whenever we're doing any form of concurrency at LMAX, we always try and focus on only ever having a single thread writing to any one piece of memory. So the idea is a thread owns some piece of memory. It might be a business logic thread, owns the business logic data. The journaler will own the journal file, so nothing else will ever try and write to that file at the same time. And once you get to that approach, you don't need any locks. You don't actually need any form of resource, any form of contention control, either CAS or locks. The only thing you need to worry about at that point is things like ordering and visibility. And that was the design approach that we took forward to the later designs of the disruptor. In fact, there's only one place throughout the disruptor code where you have any form of contention, and that's when you want to try and have multiple threads writing into the same ring buffer.
And then you use a compare and swap.
Yeah, and then we use a compare and swap.
Okay, that's easy enough. So then, I mean, you're talking about one millisecond of latency through this whole thing. I mean, let's take a typical message coming in off the wire. Walk me through this message going through all of the parts of the system then, and then finally being published out as a result on the other side. I mean, how you said 10 or so thread hops. I mean, what does this typical workflow look like?
So end-to-end is based on a fix. We use in the finance space, the fix protocol is fairly common, and that's the one that we're measuring at the moment for that 1 millisecond goal. So we get an order request over fix, so that comes into a socket-based fix server.
Did you say fax, like a paper fax?
No, fix, F-I-X.
Okay.
That'll be my accent.
One millisecond with a fax. Anyway, yes, okay.
Yep, so we get a fix message off the wire. That needs to be decoded into some form of business object by the fix server. It has to have a degree of authorization applied to that to ensure that it's being sent from the right person for the right reasons and, you know, basic sort of security requirements. It's then turned into our internal wire format, and then it's placed into a disruptor to be pushed out via multicast. We use the Informatica's Ultra Messaging Bus. So it goes over the Ultra Messaging Bus into an exchange server. That'll take the message off the wire. It will place that into a disruptor. We have four or so threads hanging off of that main disruptor. The first one has obviously got to journal the file off the disk for durability.
And so it takes that message and it sticks it on, it writes it to disk, is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, into a very fast journal file.
And I would imagine it does that like in a batch. So the messages that come in during the next 500 milliseconds write all those to disk. Does that sound right?
Slightly different. The batching algorithm we've come up with, and the one that's actually baked into the disruptor, is that you batch sort of as the messages arrive. So if you imagine something like a disk I/O, which is a bit slow, it's probably slower than your network I/O. Mm-hmm. You receive the message. The first message that turns up, you just write straight to disk. But you'll get a natural pause due to the latency of writing to that disk. So when you come back, you may have a backlog of messages.
All those and just write them out.
Yeah.
Okay, basically, so the disk is just constantly writing as fast as it can.
Yeah. And you'll just get the sort of natural batching effect. But it's really quite good because if the throughput of your disk is lower than the throughput of your network, it allows you to catch up. And in cases of when you get big bursts of traffic, it alleviates some of those queuing effects you can get with some other types of queuing systems.
Now, I would imagine that you'd have quite a bit of CPU. It'd be fairly CPU intense because here you are taking it off the wire, deserializing it into, or do you not even deserialize it to write it to the disk? You just say, here it is in raw byte form, write it to the disk.
Yep, exactly. So the format that comes off the wire, we just take a little bit of an extra header to it and then just write it off to disk. There's another thread hanging off that ring buffer that's sending over to an HA pair. So our core systems run a primary secondary.
Oh, okay. Master slave. If one goes down, the other one just picks up where it left off.
Yep. So we're sending a stream of messages out to that server. That's the exact same wire format that has been written to the journal as well. So it's all very, very consistent across the board. And so that message will arrive in a secondary, going into a very, almost the mirror of the disruptor that's happening in the primary. And as soon as that message is seen by a thread, it'll just acknowledge back the sequence number that it's seen. So once we have the message written off to disk, and once we have the message seen by the secondary, we then allow the business logic thread to continue. And that's where we do the unmarshalling and then start processing the business logic and sending out events.
Okay, now I have a question.
Yeah.
So you have, you've. It sounds like the ring buffer would be slow consumers could be problematic. So in other words, you have here's this network hop, and then you have the acknowledgement takes a long time to come. Doesn't that cause the ring buffer to back up if one consumer hasn't acknowledged up to a certain point? Does that make sense?
Yes. It's one of the reliability guarantees that we make, though. We say we won't start processing a piece of business logic until we know we've got it on disk and we know we've got it in a second memory space. So we do have some catches for that sort of thing. If we find that the secondary is for some reason down or there's a very, very slow network connection, after a period of time, we'll stop waiting for acknowledgements from the secondary. We'll switch into a mode which we call being at risk. So we know at that point, our operations team know at that point that one of our systems, there's something occurred, and we're running without HA support at that point in time.
And it's their job to get HA back online as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And the system, I would imagine, automatically detects when everything's back online and then switches back to its safe mode.
Yes. Yep. If you ever pick up the disruptor code, you'll find that's fairly key to it is sequence numbers. So we actually do just about everything but on the basis of sequence numbers.
So there's a global sequence. So you're working within a strongly consistent environment where back up for a second. You mentioned that the incoming messages were ordered. Now I know that off the wire coming, a transcontinental type, from one exchange, I don't know if you guys work on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ or anything like that, or is it just the London Exchange that you're working with?
We run it. Ours is actually our own exchange.
But in any case, it's coming out of the exchange. Messages ordering is not a guarantee of messaging, and so where do the incoming messages? How do they assign an order?
We perform that role using the disruptor. So we get some guarantees on ordering.
Let me guess. Everything is using the disruptor in your system. Like the disruptor is a pattern, and you've applied it throughout the entire system.
Yeah, pretty much. So all of our messaging and a lot of our inbound message handling uses the disruptor, pretty much across the board. That the ordering comes from. There are some ordering guarantees that we get from the messaging bus itself. So if a thread sends a message on a topic, those messages will be ordered from the same thread, if you like. So that means that if we've got something like an order placement and order cancel, if they've come off the same thread, they'll arrive in the same order. But if it's off a different machine, you lose that guarantee. As long as they're on the same topic. So that's basically the only order guarantee we get from messages being sent to us. But basically we have two threads. We have two network buses, and the messaging bus we use has basically one thread per physical network. But they are writing into the same disruptor, and the disruptor forms the role of the sequencer at that point. So it's once they're in the disruptor, that's now our global order for all of our messages. And from that point on, it's just a single stream of events all the way through to replicating to our HA peer, replicating out to our disaster recovery site, and being written to journal.
Okay, so now this global order, I mean, an integer seems rather limited at this point, at least a 32-bit integer. I mean, Is it like a 64-bit integer, or is this like a 128-bit number that just keeps getting bigger and bigger?
It's a 64-bit number.
And how close are you to the end of to wrapping around a 64-bit number?
I did a little bit of an estimate actually the other day, and at about 100 million transactions per second, it'll take about 1,400 years.
Wow. How many transactions a second? The 1,400 years was impressive, but how many transactions a second?
That would be at 100 million transactions per second.
Okay, so but you guys aren't doing anywhere near that at this
point. No, not even close to that.
I was going to say, that is a big, I mean, all the financial markets in the world don't do anything like that, so.
Yeah. So it's plenty. And by the time we get close to that, we'll probably have native support for 128-bit.
Oh, yeah, but you won't be in charge of it at that point, so it's somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so I interrupted here, and we were talking about this message that was we figured out the ordering global sequence number. It's a 64-bit integer, and then it's being written to disk. There's an I/O thread. What happens if there's no messages? Is there just like a thread spin that you've got in there where?
The disruptor comes with a couple of different strategies for this. So one of the things that we found that once you start separating along using the single writer principle is that you can separate how you wait for messages and the correctness guarantees. So we have a number of different options. We have one where it will sleep. We have one where it will use a lock and a wait notify type approach. We have one where it uses a call called thread.yield. And another one which is just a plain hard busy spin. So given different platforms, different hardware, available hardware resources should determine which one of those you use. A good example is, she turned up on the mailing list the other day, is somebody had four threads, so one disruptor producer and three consumers, all running on a dual core machine with hyperthreads. So that's four logical cores. And they were seeing some very, very weird latency results running some of our performance tests. And the interesting thing is they had selected, it was in our performance test, we had selected the busy spin strategy. And while you have four logical cores, all the threads should be able to spin independently and quite easily. What you actually find is with hyperthreading, if you've got a hard spin, it will actually steal resources from the other hyperthread because it will speculatively execute that loop. So it's seeing that condition in that loop, and it will pre-fill the instruction pipeline with a whole bunch of instructions, starving the other hyperthread of resources. So if you try and use a busy spin on a system that's only just got enough hyperthreads to support all your threads, you'll start seeing some weird latency numbers. So yielding works better in that situation.
So you're not a fan of hyperthreading then, are you?
It depends. It depends on what you're doing. There are some neat things you can do with hyperthreading. There'd be a way around this. If there is an instruction provided on x86 anyway called pause, which allows a busy spinning thread to tell the CPU to not speculatively execute the condition for that loop. Unfortunately, it's not available in Java. So the one that works best in that situation is our yielding strategy. And you apply that, and all of a sudden the latency starts coming back. But if you've got plenty of physical cores, then the busy spin one's the fastest. And then you just have the standard locks and stuff. If you're very, very starved of resources, so you're in, say, a web server, and you've got quite a lot of publishing threads or quite a lot of disruptors running, then you might want to think about a locking strategy or even maybe a sleeping strategy, depending on latency requirements.
Are you able to run the disruptor then as a framework of sorts for a web server?
Yes, I think we're using it in our web server for you know, when messages come off, so we get an HTTP request come in, we do a bit of business logic, and then when we push out, we publish the message off to our core services, the publishing component has actually got a disruptor underneath it that does all the message dispatch. I believe that somebody's started an open source project to actually write a full HTTP server using the disruptor to do all the thread management.
Wow. Okay. So sorry. Getting back to this, you know, we've got the disk. Message yep. is journaled to the disk. That's really the starting point for where things begin to happen, right?
Yep.
But you said that the disk is done concurrently with other executions. So the business logic is actually executed. You know, the message arrives off the wire. It's journaled and executed.
It's journaled and replicated. So,
replicated. Okay.
Yeah. So when we did our initial design, we focused a lot on the Cedar architecture. We have a number of stages, and originally it was sort of, here's a journaling stage, then once we've done journaling, we'll do replication. Once we've done replication, then we can do business logic. But one of the advantages of the disruptor is that you can actually parallelize a lot of those sections if you want. So we see journaling and replication as being sort of at the same level, if you like. And so those two actions can happen in parallel. And they've got different resource usages. One's using a network resource, one's using a disk resource.
So there's perfect, yeah.
There's no contention there, which is great. But the business logic needs to wait on those. But so with the way you set up the disruptor is you say, right, okay, I've got those two threads. I want to take the minimum sequence of those two, we call event handlers. And once that minimum sequence is now available, I can then start the business logic. So
once it's been journaled or replicated?
Once it's done both, in fact. So we take the minimum of the two.
Got it.
So let's say you've pumped in messages 5 through 10 into your system. You've managed to journal up to message 8, but you've managed to replicate to message 7. The business logic will come around and say, right, okay, the minimum of those two sequence numbers is 7. I can process messages 5 through 7 now. It progresses that way. So that way we have sort of a gating, but the gating is very, very lightweight. It's just looking at sequence numbers.
And as far as the sequence number, then, you know, here's these consumers that are reading the sequence number. At least in a multi-core CPU or even dual socket CPUs, things like that, you know, that number is not may not be representative of the true state of the system. And so is it just the next time it comes around, it gets the real, you know, here it's reading through 7, but in reality 8 has just been written. And yeah. So it just comes around the next time, and oh, 8's available now. Is that what happens?
Exactly. So as long as this is where the ordering and visibility constraints come in, you just want to make sure that one, the sequences are always going to be increasing. So you will only ever see messages that have been completed. You won't accidentally see a message then have the number go backwards, and you need to do something tricky to figure that out. So the way that it works is it does any piece of necessary work that needs to be done, and then it will update its sequence number. And that's where the concurrent operations come in to ensure that we order those two operations. So we make sure we order the writing into the ring buffer to the increment of the sequence, so that we make sure that the sequence doesn't increment until after that message is actually there and available to be read.
Okay, then it executes the business logic, at which yep. point it produces one or more events which go into, let me guess, a ring buffer.
Yep.
And then you have how many consumers on the other side once the the cool thing about event sourcing here, at least in this particular case, is that if the message is, let's suppose the machine resets or something like hard crash, whatever, if yep. the messages never make it out, it never happened, and so you just
exactly.
load it back up. How long does it take to load back up? You know, here your machine, I guess you have dual, you know, you said the master-slave scenario, so it doesn't really matter, but how long does it take to bring a system online if the machine reboots, whatever happens?
That can depend. Largely it comes down to how well implemented the business logic is. We did have a problem where it took quite a long time in terms of hours. At one point we did some optimization work. We're talking minutes normally.
Okay, and is it just like using a snapshotting kind of mechanism where you say, here's the state for this particular symbol or whatever in the financial market, for this symbol, here's the state at this point in time, so you just snapshot every few hundred thousand events or something?
We snapshot on a daily basis. So okay. Overnight, we have a short downtime window of about 5 minutes. at the end of the day, and we do a few operations here. One of them is just to take a global snapshot. So we take the entire system and say, here's the memory state. So in a case of failure, it's just grab that snapshot and grab the next load of journals and replay them through.
And in your case, like downtime in the middle of the night doesn't matter, does it?
No.
Okay, so then it's a perfect opportunity. If you're doing like a 24/7 global trading thing, a 5-minute downtime would be catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, there's talk of trying to move away from that. There are strategies that you can employ as well. We were thinking about doing something. One of the things I've had in my head is having a tertiary. So you've got primary, secondary, and tertiary. And then you can take the tertiary down and snapshot that and leave the primary and secondary up and running. So you'll just have you will have snapshot at a particular sequence number. Say this is the state at that point.
Yes.
So, and then if the primary and secondary go down, they can grab the snapshot from the tertiary, say, oh, is that sequence number is where it was snapshot at? I'll just start from the next sequence on in my journals from that point. And then you can hot run overnight as well.
No, and when you bring everything back online, you're bringing the state of the entire system back into memory.
Yeah.
Is that correct? So it's not like, I mean, if this was a Facebook scale thing, I mean, keeping everything in memory, well, then again, they do have lots and lots and lots of servers, but let's just imagine for a moment that they only have a few dozen servers. Keeping the entire state of the entire system in memory would be untenable, and so you would have to be working with a disk quite a bit more. I mean, have you ever considered an architecture like that where here's these short-lived business entities that have they live for a couple of hours maybe, and then they just die, and so we don't need them in memory anymore. How would you do a system like that?
That's something we already do, and that's not something the disruptor itself solves. That's just for us. We just sort of focus on a business modeling. It's sort of a business modeling problem, and you look at the particular business entities and what their life cycle is. Again, talking about the difference between orders and trades. So when a trade occurs, we don't hang on to that. We send a message out saying, "Here's the trade." That goes out to our system that reports trades out to a clearinghouse, but it persists off to a database.
At which point you remove it from memory, and it's gone, and it's done, and it's only there for reporting analytical purposes.
Yeah, and that can go through a different path, and trying to do some of the analytics across a trade, a whole big series of trades. Actually, a database is a really good tool for that. It fits quite nicely into a relational model, so we just use a relational database for it.
Okay, so then we talk about object lifecycle here. That also brings up an interesting question, at least in garbage collected environments, the Java, .NET types. Wouldn't your garbage collect – I mean, you're working with lots and lots and lots and lots of objects here. I mean, what does the garbage collection latency look like, and how does that impact your system?
It's our biggest cause of latency. It's something we probably haven't paid as much attention to as we should have early on. There are a number of strategies that you can employ. We're looking at various third-party JVM implementations that have better garbage collectors than the one that comes out of the box as a potential short-term solution. Longer term, I did some experiments, and they're actually one of the things that Disruptor does give you over and above some of the standard queuing models is it allows you to build zero garbage systems. So when you build up a Disruptor, you supply it a factory to pre-build the entries into the ring buffer. And that's something that we do. We pre-allocate a whole bunch of byte arrays there. So when a message comes in, we're not actually allocating anything. We're simply copying the message from the wire into the byte array inside of the disruptor.
Now, in the disruptor there, I think this – I just had a little aha moment. Is this – I mean, the messages in the buffer are pure bytes. Is that right?
In our case, yes.
Okay, because I was thinking of like object references – going through the entire system, at least in one process space.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can do both. The disruptor allows for either. But in terms of if you want to go for very very low garbage systems and very latency sensitive systems, we find the best approach is to use the disruptors for handling the serialized forms of the messages. So in a typical system, if you look at it from our perspective, you see there's a disruptor for all the messages coming in, and they're storing the serialized form that they arrived onto the network in. And then there'll be a disruptor for messages that are going back out to outbound events. And they've actually got the serialized form to be written out onto the network. So we do all the unmarshalling in the same thread as the business logic. And that sort of seems to be the easiest way to give you a very deterministic memory usage for entries in the disruptor.
Interesting. That's okay. I'm going through that. The only time you ever really need to deserialize something is when you is when you're doing the business behavior, because it then needs to be in an object form, and then finally just serialize it back to the byte stream, and then and then maybe like a transition going back over to the exchange or to whatever to interact with an external system.
Yeah. So you're basically, if you look at most of our disrupt usage, you're basically storing the serialized form. There are a couple of techniques that we've been playing with in terms of actually reducing the garbage created on deserialization. There's a couple of tools floating out there. Javolution is an example of one where you can actually, rather than creating an object from the serialized form via some sort of stream, is you actually do sort of like an overlay style behavior, so that if you imagine you have an interface that defines your business object, you can push a byte array or a byte buffer behind that, and you say, okay, get me the ID. And all it knows is the offset into that underlying byte buffer, and we'll just take the eight or so bytes that's needed, pull those out, convert those into a long, and return them to you. So you're only ever dealing with, the only time you're actually going in and creating any data as such is when you actually get down to the primitive level of your object model. It's an interesting approach. I've prototyped it and it works very, very well. You do have the constraint though, from the developer perspective, that a message only has a limited life cycle. It's only valid for the lifetime of the request. So if you need to take it out and store it somewhere, you need to construct an object to represent it. But if you modeled your problem well enough, you know, they'll probably have a natural home.
Now, all of these things are just, you know, here's this extreme optimizations that you found for your business domain. You know, have you benchmarked this system in terms of number of messages per second per core? I mean, what does this typically look like?
We've got some. We've got quite a decent set of performance tests. So we try and run as close to sort of very similar to our live load as possible. Our total throughputs are not as high as some exchanges, but the really interesting perspective is when you actually look at burst traffic. You can get a lot of messages effectively arrive in the same TCP packet. So while you may only be dealing with 1 to 2,000 messages per second, you can often run into situations that you have 30, 40, 50 messages turn up on the same microsecond. So this is where a lot of the performance stuff comes in, especially around some of the smart batching algorithms. So when you get this big burst of messages, you can deal with it as efficiently as possible. So we've built performance tests that look at the sort of the bursting behavior we're seeing in production and try and replicate that in our performance tests as well, and try and see if we can get sort of similar latency numbers in our performance testing environment that we see in production, then optimize from there.
I mean, I guess the big thing here for you guys, of course, is the latency, and then as far as messages per second, you can always just scale this thing out to more machines to get to achieve higher numbers.
Yeah, I mean, our throughput's fairly, it's fairly stable. For our throughput to jump a large amount, there actually has to be some sort of business change. So either we're putting new instruments into the system for people to trade on, or provisioning new market makers are the main things that will drive additional volume. So our throughput numbers are fairly predictable. So normally the way we do performance testing is we don't say how many messages per second can we do. We normally say we should be able to do, well, here's our business, our current production flow. Let's put a factor on that, 2, 3, 10, whatever. Say, right, we need to be able to do that. Now let's make the latency acceptable.
So it's all about the latency. But even so, I mean, in terms of messages per second, I'm just curious, is it, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 50, 100, a million messages per second per core that you're able to do?
In terms of the whole system end to end?
Let's do just your business logic, and then let's expand out and do the whole system.
Business logic, it's gone up and down from we had it. Initial implementation was able to do millions of messages per second. As we've added features, that's come down. We've been doing optimizations to bring that back up. It's somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million messages per second.
That is so cool.
the really interesting thing is most of that doesn't come from high-end optimizations. Most of that comes from, one, being purely in memory. Just go for a pure in-memory model. Being really, really careful with your domain modeling. So really understanding the business problem, designing it really well, and then standard computer science 101, right data structures, the right algorithms can get you to those sorts of levels. And a lot of people are really surprised by that. And that's a single thread. So we actually only have one business logic thread in our system, which surprises a lot of people. you know, and a lot of people think, oh, modern software, you have to go very, very heavily concurrent. But we actually find that you can do quite a lot on a single thread, especially if you're avoiding any of the complexities of locking and CAS operations or any form of concurrency or concurrent structures.
I mean, it sounds like the disruptor pattern is just non-blocking on steroids.
Pretty much.
Non-blocking, yeah, not just disk I.O., non-blocking at the CPU level, non-blocking memory. I mean, just you don't even need like software transactional memory, STM, anything like that. It's just non-blocking all the way through the entire system. That is so cool.
Yeah, so that was the basic idea of the design, is just to move messages between threads as fast as possible.
Okay, so then from an end-to-end perspective, how long? What is your? You said your goal was 1 millisecond end-to-end. Did I hear that right?
Yep.
And I would imagine you're achieving that.
We're getting close to it. We're getting close to it. We probably can't officially release our numbers, but our mean is fairly close to that goal, and our 2.9s and 4.9s stretch a bit further out, with the biggest constraint on that being just being garbage collection. So that's our biggest challenge at the moment, to bring those numbers down, is finding a better way, you know, either creating less garbage or finding a way to, you know, bring in a garbage collector that's better than what we currently have.
No, and when you say end-to-end, this is traveling between multiple, there's several network hops in between.
Yep.
So there'll be
four network hops. So there's a hop from our fixed server that's doing the original message decode to the exchange. There's the replication hop and acknowledgement back, and then there's the hop back to the fixed server to send the acknowledgement to the order back out to the end user. So
wow,
four network hops there.
That is so cool. And all approaching 1 millisecond. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, because here we are, at least in my domain, you know, if it's half second, that's probably pretty good, you know, per message. Just no big deal. You know, we can do higher than that, but it's... So to hear this kind of volume is always interesting to see, because at that point, I mean, it drives your architecture a lot more profoundly than it does in at least my case, because our latency requirements are so low. It's like, oh, as long as it happens. I mean, for us, it's the reliable messaging, not necessarily the latency that really gets us.
Yeah, it does focus the mind. It forces you to think about... with a lot of the high performance stuff and the low latency stuff, the most obvious thing is it's all about simplicity. It's okay, here's my flow end to end. What can I remove from it? What, you know, that's the best optimization is the one where you just don't do something. So especially talking to some of the other people in the industry, largely it's about pulling out parts of the infrastructure that get in the way. A good example, and one that comes up a lot, especially on just the low latency networking part, is kernel bypass. So you can actually go faster if your message doesn't have to travel through the kernel. So there's a couple of network card vendors, for example, that do a fully in user space TCP stack. So their device driver just simply talks to a chunk of memory, a bit of memory mapped I/O, to grab the packets off the wire, and then, you know, does all the TCP decoding in user space to avoid all of the all of the costs of the kernel in terms of doing all the device management.
Wow. Now, I do have to ask about the operating system choice then. You know, here, I've worked with Fedora, I've worked with Debian, Ubuntu, various, you know, flavors of Ubuntu. But I'm curious why the choice for Fedora/Red Hat Enterprise.
It was just what we were using at the time. It seemed like the best choice when we made it. We've been running the same platform production for quite a few years now, and we've got a big hardware refresh. So we're going back to the drawing board a little bit, looking at what's going to be the most appropriate solution. The biggest drivers of that nowadays, what JVMs does it support? There's a number of other Java virtual machines in the market. Azul has one, IBM has one that we're looking at. And it's what platforms do they support is one of my key constraints. If it doesn't run on Ubuntu server, then, well, it, you know, maybe we shouldn't really be considering Ubuntu server. Just about everything runs on Red Hat Enterprise. SUSE's enterprise server seems to be another common one that people are willing to support. So that's probably the biggest driver. Fedora is quite nice in the fact that you can stay very, very up to date with the latest kernels. One of the things that we really want to do in production, we're still running a fairly old kernel, and we want to go to some of the newer kernels which have some of the low latency, software preemptive or scheduling changes that have come in more recent kernels, which should give us a performance boost.
Now, as far as Linux goes, I'm gonna kind of throw this out there. You know, what kind of performance would you expect out of the disruptor on a Windows-based system? You know, dozens of messages per second, perhaps?
It's pretty good, actually. One of the interesting differences between Windows and Linux for sort of server-side messaging and things like that, where you're trying to just get, messages passed backwards and forwards, we actually find that Windows schedule is better, which was really surprising, because people often say, people talk a lot about Linux and how good the scheduler is. And actually, just doing a simple ping pong style test with we were testing just with a lock, in fact, and measuring the overall runtime. If you run the same test without using Thread Affinity or anything like that, the result on Windows system is actually about 4 or 5 times better than on Linux. So one of the things you can also apply to that is you can actually set up Thread Affinity. Once you start setting Thread Affinity, everything sort of comes back down to the same level and is quite a bit faster again. So, it's interesting that at times in certain workloads, the Windows scheduler is quite a bit better.
So in your case, with Thread Affinity, what you're referring to is that here's this thread and it owns this particular task, and so you never have to deal with swapping and context switching and bringing it in and out of main memory and so forth. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're just saying, he's telling the kernel in the strongest possible way to say, keep this thread on this core, because it's going to do the same thing for quite some time, and I want its cache to stay hot, and I want it not to be moved about.
Do you have
And one of the
really big, like your CPUs, do they have really good size level one, level two caches on them?
We're using some of the Xeon chips and stuff like that, which have the much larger caches than the standard desktop chips. The biggest cost in terms of context switching, it's not the cost of the OS context switch itself. It's the fact that if you're on one core and your thread gets swapped out and brought back on a different core, it's the cost of having to rebuild the cache. So it's the number of cache misses you're getting by having your thread rescheduled quite a lot. And we found that with the Windows scheduler, without any form of Thread Affinity, the threads tend to stay roughly on the same core. With Linux, it seems to hop them about quite a bit, and you start seeing quite a big cost in terms of those cache misses coming through. And that's where you see the additional performance hit.
And here you talk about keeping everything in memory. You're not just talking about like in main RAM space. You're talking about as much as you can in L1, L2.
Well, being or trying to design your algorithms and trying to think about your data structures in ways that you make life easy for the compiler and the CPU to keep those sorts of things hot. A good example is internally in our inside the disruptor, we use arrays rather than linked lists, for example. So as your threads are moving through the disruptor, picking up the events, you start to get things like cache striding benefits. So
So it takes
as
the
you
whole array and it puts it into the L2 cache.
If possible, the other thing a CPU can do is if you're moving very predictably through memory, if you going in a linear sequence, and I believe if you get two cache misses in a row, or two page faults in a row, one or the other, I can't remember exactly which, it will go, ah, you're heading in that direction through memory. What I'll start doing is start prefetching those cache lines into memory. So by the time you get there, it's already hot in cache. Or something like a linked list, because the pointers in the linked list can be to anywhere in memory. There's no way the CPU can see any sort of predictable memory access profile, so it can't do any sort of prefetching or any optimization of your algorithm.
Now, and you've talked a lot about Java, and at least in the Java world here in the last year or so, there's been quite a bit of talk, regarding Oracle and licensing and all these kinds of, even to the extent that Google has who has largely used Java, has even considered moving off of them. And I was curious if you guys had even any considerations along those lines. Is Java an old language? Would you upgrade to something newer that, or has it just been working great for you guys and let's keep going with it?
Yeah, we're sort of in the it works for us and it works well. When I personally am not in the space where I see a lot of talk in the Java community about some of the newer programming languages. So there's a lot of talk about Scala and Clojure and Groovy and all those sorts of things. And I was originally, a big fan of some of these things, but more and more, especially working with people like Martin Thompson and my boss, a guy called Dave Farley, the more and more I work with these sorts of guys, the more and more I focus on what I'm doing and actually understanding the problem and modeling it, the language almost sort of fades into the background. often you'll come across across a problem and say, oh, well, if I had Scala, it'd be really easy. I'll just create a closure. But I've got a very awkward implementation in Java. But I find actually starting to focus on what's the problem I'm trying to solve? How does this actually work? What's the business model? The model starts to evolve, and then you write the Java code, and it's actually still pretty simple. So I think it's I personally find that the argument to move to another programming language, for example, because it's easier, is often a case that people haven't really put the effort into thinking about the business problem well enough to model it really well in Java. So it's one of those things that works for me. I'm fairly confident that Java for businesses anyway who are making an investment in it will be fine. It'll be well maintained. They're throwing lots and lots of people resources into testing and development to keep the Java ecosystem going. I know they've done some damage to the community, and I believe that they're actively trying to repair that.
Yeah, with Oracle, you never know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay. So then another question I have is regarding the testing strategy, because here you have this unfiltered byte stream coming in from your effects server, and rogue packets or just malformed messages, things like that. How do you prevent that? Because I could see a situation where you have this malformed request coming in, and everything's in memory, and then all of a sudden your business logic throws an exception or something like that, and all of a sudden now you have to. How do you prevent that, or is that even a problem?
Upfront validation and a lot of automated testing is basically our approach. I know that you can use you could use things like STM and stuff like that. So if you get a message and it may corrupt your state, you simply roll back to the previous version and discard the whole event. We tend not to do that because of the high memory allocation and garbage collection costs of building a system like that. So we spend a lot of time doing a lot of automated testing. to talk about process for a little bit, the way we generally develop is very story based. So we have a new piece of functionality come through from the business they want us to add. We do some modeling, we try and understand the problem, and then we build out a set of automated acceptance tests for that run end to end. We then write those tests, put them in, they'll fail initially, do the necessary work to get them to pass, and then commit the whole lot into our source code control system, which then deploys several copies of the whole system onto a fairly large grid of machines and then just runs all of these tests. We've got about 4,000 odd, and it takes around about 35 to 40 minutes to run all of those tests. But the interesting thing is we also, by doing a huge number of tests, especially on a single system, is we get a lot of the noise, if you like. So we don't really see too many problems with corrupted packets. But the interesting one is it finds a lot of concurrency bugs. We found concurrency bugs in our messaging products, in MySQL, just the result of every single time we do a commit to our source code control system, we're bringing the whole system up and running a huge barrage of tests concurrently. So we have maybe 20 or 30 clients driving a single system at a time, each running their own individual tests.
And so at that point, it drives out all these concurrency issues. So, you said you're using MySQL. Is that the database you guys are using just for message reporting and so forth?
Yeah, storing trade histories, users' own order histories, things like just the basic CRUD style things like instrument metadata. Account information and principal information, things like all of our financial reporting, those sorts of things we use the database for. Because it's on a different cycle, it's got different latency requirements, and also things like financial reporting just falls naturally within into the relational model.
Now, as far as the database size then, are you starting to run into other little issues with the database where you have to start sharding the load because you have so much going into it? Or are these tables getting extremely large, terabytes in size? Or what's your sharding strategy look like there?
The volume of data in our database is a lot lower than we expected it to be. Early on, we did put a lot of engineering effort, and we actually in production put a lot of resource into the database, and it's barely being touched. we're doing a bit of a refresh and a re-architecture fairly soon. We're going to pull away some of that resource and make it available for other systems. Our really heavy volume I/O is actually all very, generally very simple files. We tend to not use databases for the stuff that we're trying to write 1,000, 2,000 times a second. We find actually journal files tend to be a much better solution for that type of problem because they're often written sequentially and often read sequentially as well. So we very rarely need some of the advanced indexing and searching features.
And as far as, you know, here's these journal files, what about data corruption and so forth, silent data corruption? What file system are you guys running on?
We're running X3 at the moment. EXT3.
Okay.
And that was pretty well. We most of the time we're trying to run replicas. It seems to be for us the easiest way to give you redundancy is to try and do a lot of the replication at the application level. So like we're saying with so we've got primary, secondary, we've also got a DR system for exchange. We're looking to sort of build that out. Same with we've got a system for storing historic market data. What we've done is got a system in production, a system in DR, and they're both making their own copies of the data. So you can make sure you can do various checks to make sure that you're not getting some sort of silent corruption or something's broken in that space.
So at that point, I mean, do you guys like do any sort of hashing on the files every so often to make sure that there's no corruption going on within them, or is it just the replication it takes care of it for you?
We haven't done so much hashing. That's something I think we should probably put in. But good examples is we do a lot of testing of the replication and journaling system. So one of the tests we do after we've run our 4,000 acceptance tests is we shut the system down, taking a snapshot, bring it back up, then run a bunch of tests through to make sure the memory state is still consistent. We then shut it down, delete the snapshots, and force a journal replay, and make sure again that the memory state is still consistent, run a few tests through it that way. So we tend to focus a lot more on testing in the continuous integration space than we have on some of the other things like, you know, taking hashes and doing reliability checks in production. But it's something we're definitely looking into, probably do more of in the future.
Wow, this is amazing. So I guess, are there any other aspects of the disruptor that you wanted to comment on and put out there? I know you guys have a number of different papers and there's an InfoQ presentation on this, but are there other aspects that you wanted to just put out there to help us understand a little bit more about it?
I'm trying to think of what would be a good thing to mention. I think the key things with the disruptor, if you're wanting to look at it and understand concurrency, I mean, the main thing for us, especially when it comes to high performance concurrency, is the single writer pattern. That is pretty much number one, is just any way that you can avoid contention, do it. And the disruptor is an example of us doing that. Probably the most interesting aspects in terms of performance are, one, the ability to reuse the slots in the ring buffer, to be able to have a choice between having, you know, perhaps the style of having newly constructed immutable message events to having byte arrays that can be mutated and overwritten and reused in a way that's completely safe as well. So we take care of the concurrency control there. Probably third is the parallelization capabilities. The idea that, like what we do with the journaler and the replication, that you've got two independent resources that are undercontended, both of those event processors can read from the ring buffer in a free, uncontended fashion and do things in parallel. And then gating on these things to find out where they're up to is fairly simple by simply looking at the minimum of those two sequences.
I have a question there just to make sure I get this right. So you have one producer, two consumers.
Yep.
You know, consumer one needs to indicate that it's done back to the producer, and consumer two also needs to indicate, or no, the producer doesn't even care, does it? It just keeps going.
There is an indication. Everything is done off sequence number. So if you pick up the disruptor code, there is a class called sequence. And so the disruptor itself has a sequence, which we call the cursor. And then every independent event handler has its own sequence. So the way that we avoid any form of write contention is that when a message is consumed by an event handler, rather than going back and telling the ring buffer or the sequencer that it's consumed that message, it just increments its own counter saying, here's where I'm up to.
And that's a structure inside of the disruptor, so that way you don't wrap around and get ahead of the slowest consumer.
Yep. So the disruptor itself, you pass to the disruptor a set of sequences that you want to say, these are the things to gate on. You know, don't wrap around the ring buffer until you see that this particular sequence number has reached a certain point. So we have the wrap protection built in as well. But you can even switch it off. You don't have to put, you know, you can specify a sequence that's, you know, or an empty set of sequences, so it doesn't even worry about that too much. One of the other very, very nice benefits of doing it that way by having the event handler increments its sequence once it's done is you get some transactional behavior that you don't get with queues. So if you imagine when you're trying to shut a system down cleanly at the end of the day, one of the common things to do is you allow the system to quiesce. So you turn off the input taps and let all the messages drain out the system. You wait till all your queues are empty, and then you shut the system down, knowing you're in a known good state. There is a slight corner case with that, as the queue could be empty, but the thread that's taken the message from the queue may not have finished its business logic yet. So it may be yet to write a message out to a queue further down the line. By updating a sequence after all the work is complete, all we have to do is just track and make sure all the sequence numbers are up to the same value. And at that point, we can be assured that the system is quiesced.
So you shut down the producer regardless, and yep. then just wait till the consumer indexes are up to that cursor level, and then yep. shut it
and
down.
Then you can be, yeah, and then you can be assured that even that both the disruptor's empty and also the running threads have finished the piece of logic that they were working on.
This is all very fascinating. I mean, the reading for it as I was going through, it was like just very revealing to see the insides of the CPU and stuff, because it's a lot of the stuff is so close to the metal that it doesn't really matter, at least in a lot of what I've been working with. But in your case, the CPU architecture matters a lot. And I mean, I could see a pattern like this being adopted straight into the JVM after a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, we'd love that to happen. I know a couple of guys from our company went over to Java 1 last year, and there was a lot of people who were very enthusiastic about it. Going, yeah, this should be in the standard library. It would be really great. So, you know, hopefully, it'd be interesting to see if that does happen. It'll take time, I think, if it does.
Java 9, Java 10, maybe.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, if anything, I mean, they're still umming and ahhing about thread affinity at the moment in Java. So I think that's maybe Java 9.
I know the ZeroMQ guys are. I guess their hope is that it'll be adopted straight into the Linux kernel, and so they have.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think there are. It's interesting. There actually are other structures that are ring buffer based, floating around in device drivers and stuff. The really amusing comment that we had from one guy. I think it was actually a guy from Azul, and he was looking at our disruptor architecture. And we were explaining it all to him. He goes, that looks like a high-speed network card. And that was really, you know, quite interesting. That actually the design itself is not new at all. It's simply just an application of a lot of old ideas and principles into a new domain. And that actually, there's probably, if you dig around, there's probably a lot of other, places, you know, generally in the high-performance computing space that have actually got similar designs already.
So, for me, you know, I look at this architecture. And it really sounds, I mean, messaging is just the core piece that goes throughout it. It permeates the entire system, messaging.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that seems to be the, you know, with the high performance, you know, as opposed to just HTTP REST, you know, everyone talks about how REST is going to be the, well, we could just use REST and do HTTP, and that's going to be, you know, your system will be as scalable as the web. But, I mean, in the end, it all comes down to messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I find most important about messaging is that, and one of the things we try to do, especially in our high performance spaces of our architecture, is be absolutely strict with asynchronous behavior. So avoid the request reply style of messaging. So avoid having the case where you've got an inbound, you've got a thread sending a message, and it has to stop and wait for the response event. We try to be very, very strict about saying, right, we send an event out, we're not going to wait for the response. It'll turn up sometime later, or maybe we don't care about it, but we're not going to stop and block that thread until that occurs. We find that's one of the biggest constraints to scalability, because often your piece of logic is very, very short, and getting it dispatched onto a thread for the disruptor to push out asynchronously, compared to the amount of time it has to wait for the message to go out in the wire, across the network, into the service, back out and back to you is order of magnitudes different. So if you're talking about trying to scale a system up in terms of the number of threads, the amount of cores that you need available to process all your inbound requests, if all of that logic processing is purely asynchronous, then actually it will scale a lot better because the amount of time your thread is tied up waiting for stuff, you know, shrinks incredibly. It's one of these approaches that takes a little bit of time up front. It's a bit of a cost initially. You have to start thinking in terms of asynchronous models. Probably the state machine model is one of the best that we've seen. So you send an event out, you move your system into a particular state, an event comes back with some sort of correlation ID, you find the appropriate piece of business data, and then you just adjust its state again based on that event coming in. And but once you adopt it, you sort of pay that over, that you sort of pay that sort of mental overhead or that mental cost in terms of your understanding. But once you've paid it, it's pretty much that across the board. The cost of doing sort of synchronous request reply type systems is that they seem very, very attractive and easy early on, but they're ridiculously difficult to make scale well. That's one of the lessons we've learned. We introduced in our infrastructure sort of a request reply mechanism, and we regretted it ever since.
That's typically the case. Rina, do you have any other questions for Mike about the disruptor pattern?
Not really. I've been hysterically taking notes over the entire talk, and it's like, okay, I don't have any questions because my on-ring buffer is overloaded with the information I have to digest.
Yeah, that happens from time to time. When I was reading the papers on the disruptor, it was like, whoa, this is really good stuff, you know, because non-blocking I/O wasn't a big deal, but at least again for what I'm doing. But I can see how by taking that out of the picture, getting rid of the blocking, I should say, at every single level, can make it scale to crazy, ridiculous levels. And I would imagine that in most programming languages, that you could achieve generally, you know, similar degrees. I guess it depends on the language implementation, but you know, high performance. I guess there is a .NET implementation of the disruptor that's, you know, they claim you know, a few hundred thousand messages a second that they can squeeze out of it, as compared to the Java, where you guys are mentioning, you know, several million per second.
They're doing pretty well, actually. We've met the guy, actually, Olivier, who's doing the .NET port. He's done a really good job of it as well. He stays really current with what we're doing. It was a couple of factors different at most. It's definitely less than an order of magnitude difference. I know when he was first starting, I haven't seen his performance numbers recently, but I know when he was first starting, we were quoting 25 million and he was quoting 17 million, those sorts of differences. So it's staying very current. It's staying, and it's still providing, I think, a lot better performance than some of the internal .NET queuing implementations.
Yeah. Here we're excited now with .NET 4.0. We have a non-blocking, a concurrent queue where we don't have to do our own locking and stuff. And it does it all internally, but it still just locks and compare and swap operations under the hood.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it's interesting just to benchmark these things. I think that's what one of the things I find most interesting is, especially in the Java space, is people tend to look at what people are telling them and then don't do any tests. The number of times I've seen talks on concurrent frameworks and new language features and new tools is they'll talk about how great the tool is and how well it works with multi-core systems, but there won't be any numbers. There won't be any numbers that reflect how much better it is. And that's one of the things we've tried to do from day one with the disruptor is, you know, have performance testing sort of front and center and say, you know, not claim anything unless we've got numbers to back it up. And, you know, I think it's not only makes the argument more convincing, but it's actually pushed us to try harder and harder to actually make those numbers look better and better.
Well, now, with the disruptor, I mean, I would imagine that the pattern's fairly well established and integrated into your architecture. And so Do you spend a lot of time tweaking the disruptor itself, or do you spend most of your time now working with the ancillary? And when I say ancillary, what I really mean is the primary systems like the business logic and so forth.
It's more in the business logic, and we have an infrastructure wrapper over that that does the things like the marshalling. It has a couple of layers, so it makes events look a bit like method calls. So you just pass a bunch of objects into a method call that takes care of the dispatch and the messaging and the reliability and the reinvoking on the other side. But that's been fairly stable for a while as well. The biggest thing for us, especially from the performance perspective now, is the garbage collection. That's what we're largely fighting. And then other things we're putting a lot of effort into are things like monitoring, stuff like that. So there are little tweaks happening to the disruptor. We released 2.8 a little while ago. We ran into a problem with the situation where you've got multiple threads writing into a single disruptor. A lot of customers, well, a lot of people using disruptor were coming back and saying, on systems where they've got lots of threads all quite heavily contending on the disruptor, they're seeing very, very poor performance numbers. And I was able to replicate those numbers. And so I had to do a tweak recently to change the way that the multi-threaded claim strategy works, such that we could deal with that contention in a fairly clean and efficient way. And it's one of the interesting observations about contention. Not only does it make things slow, it makes things really, really complicated. If you look at the code for the multi-threaded claim strategy versus the single-threaded claim strategy, it's just so much more complicated because you're having to deal with these multiple things trying to write to the same piece of data.
And then you have to deal with the compare and swaps and atomicity at the CPU level and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, one other question I had just to wrap things up. You talked about the master-slave a little bit. I was just curious to find out a little bit more about that, how primary system failure, how does this, is there just some kind of heartbeat where the slave just picks up and says, oh, they left off at this? I mean, if you're going and doing the same code on both systems and only one of them is producing out actually to the wire, the slave, I would imagine, would just watch that and say, okay, now I know where it left off and it knows where to start up.
We're still actually running, it's a bit more of a warm standby, so it's a manual switchover operation at the moment. The way that it works internally is that the state is exactly the same. So the primary and secondary look exactly the same. And actually, to the secondary, it's just receiving the same stream of events. It happens to be over a slightly different channel, but it's still going into the same instance of the disruptor, the same business logic, the same journaling, and actually the same replication and events being sent out. All we've done on the actual sending threads on the other side of the disruptor is we just switch off the actual send. So it's just basically doing no-op operations on the other side. So the state is replicated across the two.
Oh, so the dispatcher, like everything, like it's got, it does the same business operations, and then when it goes out to publish over the wire, it just says no-op.
Yeah, so there's just basically a Boolean switch. Am I on? No. Don't actually write to the disk, or don't actually write to the network device. So the ring buffers that sit in front of the publishers for messages going back out on the wire are still filled up with the same set of events. And this is where the determinism becomes very, very important. So making sure you have deterministic business logic is very important. So in the case that if we failed over to the secondary and somebody tried to late join in again, we've got the same exact buffer of messages for them to replay if they need it.
But granted, your latency is a lot higher, during a switchover operation. But hopefully that's, do you have you ever had to pull the switch and, the primary's got some problems and had to shut it down and bring the secondary up and have it take over?
No, we haven't as yet. We haven't had an incident like that in production, but I'm certain it will happen one day.
have you run tests for that just to make sure you can, this is what like Netflix does and stuff. They're like, hey, let's do they're using the Amazon cloud and they say, oh, let's shut this system down and see what happens and see if everything else, like our failovers, work properly.
Yeah, we'd like to. Our latency requirements are very, very tight. So something like that will probably perturb the system a bit too much from a latency perspective. But I think there's things that we'd like to do. We'd like to be able to hot deploy, for example. And the only way to do that is to have some form of cutover in the middle of the day. So the way that we test this is, again, we have an automated system test, which shuts one of the systems down, promotes the other one, ensures that messages are still flowing between the two, and then brings the other one back in and has it late join, switches back over between the two, and ensures that the state's correct. So we're confident that it works. Have we done it in production? Not yet. We do have to do DR failover tests in production, but we tend to do those offline.
So that way you don't have to actually worry about it really affecting things.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed a lot of the details that you've been been giving here. You know, I guess in many respects, if our listeners don't necessarily, if they're not as familiar with the disruptor pattern, it almost seems like a precursor to this podcast to go in and just look at what's going on and then listen to this. Because this is a big fire hose to listen to without any background.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, it's actually quite a simple piece of code. If you ever have a chance to look at it, it's probably only about 2,000-3,000 lines of code in total. But you know, and it's actually very, very simple, but it's an abstraction over some, you know, quite deep concepts. And that's why we've spent a lot of time writing about it and talking about it and doing presentations on it, because there's actually a lot of learning there as well. And that's what we think is actually most valuable. My personal opinion is that I've seen a lot of people talking about concurrency in the industry, and they use the term, our tools are woefully inadequate. And I don't believe that personally. I think our tools are pretty good. I think it's, as developers, our understanding is woefully inadequate. We don't spend enough time digging down, and the experts are not helping us understand. They're building tools for us to use, but not actually increasing our own understanding. And one of the important reasons for that is that actually at the CPU level, all concurrency is the same. All concurrency is shared memory concurrency, and there's a bunch of instructions that help you with ordering and visibility. And every tool that you run into, including the disruptor and STM, actor models, all these sorts of things, are simply abstractions over that concurrency model. But being an abstraction, there's a translation cost between that abstraction and what's actually happening. And if you don't understand where that translation cost occurs, then you're not going to know what's going to be most appropriate for your system. So it's about sort of understanding what's happening lower down. Given a tool that I'm going to use, what are the costs I'm going to be paying? Do those costs become fairly light in terms of the type of application I'm building, or do they become very, very heavy?
Well, thank you very much. This is, like I said, it's been an excellent to listen to. This seems like one of those where I want to have a follow-up here, but it's going to be a while, because to wrap my brain around all the implications here is going to take a while. So thank you again.
Okay, you're welcome. And yeah, if you want to do a follow-up, no problem. Just let me know when you'd like to do it.
And we'll schedule a year out or something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, probably just on closing, there's obviously the disruptor page. It's on Google Code. There's also, we'll make sure there's plenty of links up there, but there's quite a long series of blog posts written by a colleague of mine called Tricia G about understanding the various components of the disruptor. A lot of people say that they've read the paper, found it a bit dry and academic, but have read Tricia's posts, and they're a lot more accessible, and they provide a lot more understanding a lot more quickly. And then Trish and I have also done a couple of talks about some of the internals of Disruptor. So I'll make sure those are all available and linked to from the Google Code website.
And we can put those in the show notes as well. I've gone over most of that stuff. The paper I thought it was quite fascinating, just because it was such a different way of thinking about the problems from the traditional models. But in any case, this has been a great podcast. So Renat, any final closing thoughts?
Well, not really, aside from the fact that this really detailed and really nice explanation of Disruptor seems to be like almost a detailed recipe for building an event store.
Excellent. Okay, so that's it for today, and we'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.